Flexibility is great. That's why there's yoga. Flexibility for your insurance coverage is great too. That's why there's United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, United Healthcare Insurance Plans offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. One of these plans may be right for you if you're, say, between jobs, coming off your parents' plan, turning a side hustle into a full hustle, or even missed open enrollment. Want more flexibility? Find out more about United Healthcare Insurance Plans at uh1.com.
Well, hello, Chris Evans here with a special edition of the Best of the Breakfast Show podcast with Sky from Virgin Radio and happiness guru Arthur C. Brooks. This guy is a genius. And what follows is a 25-minute express train of absolute gold if you're of a certain age. We're talking about sort of post-40-ish. He has proven with his social science that we get happier, or at least should do, with every decade past about the age of 47.2. And if you don't believe me, have a listen.
He's a classical musician turned public policy analyst turned happiness expert. If that's not enough, he's just authored his 12th book, From Strength to Strength, which we've all read from cover to cover. And here to tell us more, it's King of the Books, Arthur C. Brooks.
Nice, Jane. Good morning, Arthur.
Good morning, Chris. How are you? The legendary Chris Evans.
Well, my goodness me, the legendary Arthur C. Brooks. So who's the guy on the plane? Come on.
I can't tell you.
Come on!
Oh, it would be indiscreet. Besides, I'm averse to lawsuits.
Right. For people who don't know, why am I referencing a man on a plane?
It's the man who changed my life. I was on a plane 8 years ago. I was the president of a think tank, which for your listeners who don't know, that's a research organization, like a university without students in Washington, D.C. It was a CEO traveling around feeling like a real big shot, but I didn't have any end game and I was feeling pretty insecure. I was 50 years old thinking, where does this end? What am I supposed to do with my life? And I heard a man behind me on the plane explaining to his wife. I could tell he was elderly. He was speaking to, I assumed it was his wife, explaining that he might as well be dead. And his wife saying, oh, it's not true. And he said, nobody remembers me anymore. And I thought, oh, this poor guy, he's been forgotten. He probably actually never amounted to much. He's disappointed. The lights went on at the end of the flight and everybody stood up. And I turned around. He was one of the most famous men in the world. A hero, a great man doing 10 times with his life as much as me. And I thought to myself, what is my plan? So I will not be explaining to my long-suffering wife, Esther, some 30 or 40 years hence, that I might as well be dead. And I put together a plan as a social scientist, my retirement plan for happiness, which is this book.
And it's amazing. So thanks to him, imagine if you hadn't got on the flight. I think you'd have probably arrived at a similar point anyway, don't you?
It's hard to say. You need a catalytic event. You know, some people get sick. Some people lose somebody that they love. It's usually a trying thing, but you're on a particular path. You need an inflecting experience that'll...
Okay. Your book starts with some great phrases. None of this is easy. It's hard to teach an old striver new tricks, because we think we're meant to strive and therefore we become a striver and then we feel like we're running out of striving juice, as it were, but that's okay.
Yeah. You know, the problem is that what makes you good is not something that you can maintain. And you know, there's a lot of, I'm a social scientist, I teach happiness at Harvard University, believe it or not, and but you know, people ask, what do you teach? And I say happiness, they think I'm lying. How can that possibly be? Only Americans, right, could have a subject like this. And one of the things that you find is that what people who are real strivers, hard workers, excellent people, my students, you, a lot of people listening to us who really want to do a lot with their lives, they get better and better and better in their 20s and 30s, but things start to get harder in their 40s and 50s. And this has to do with the structure of intelligence. There's a thing called fluid intelligence that gets better in your 20s and 30s and worse in your 40s and 50s. And if you don't understand that, you're going to have a lot of frustration facing you. You need to get on a second intelligence curve, and that's what this book is really all about. Your happiness retirement plan requires getting on your second curve.
So that's crystallized.
Exactly right. Okay. Which comes in your 40s and 50s, stays high in your 60s and 70s, but it's a different set of skills and you need a different set of disciplines in your life to get there.
Now, I sense this happiness that you're talking about, this second wave, this second curve. And we've been talking about it all morning ahead of you coming in, and we've had loads of reaction already, and we've been playing clips from your friendship con on Rich's podcast. I feel like it's a, I wouldn't say a better happiness, because that's too judgmental and too pejorative on my former years and other people in of similar ages. But it feels more wholesome. It feels more holistic, and you speak to that in your book as well. But is that because I'm just so darn relieved that it's still okay?
It has a lot to do with the fact that your second happiness curve, your second success curve, has everything to do with serving others and having better relationships with other people. Your first, your fluid intelligence curve, where you're excellent at what you're doing, you're an individual, you're a ninja, you're like a big star, a cowboy. You know, this is how we like to think of it in States, at least. You come up, and you, and later when it starts to diminish, you got to get on the second curve, which is your otherness curve, your wisdom curve, your teacher. It's your Dalai Lama curve, basically. Chris, you're on your Dalai Lama curve. No wonder you're happy.
It's so funny because we have two ladies who invented the AstraZeneca vaccine in Tomorrow, because they've got their book out. And the first person blurbing on that book is me. And the first blurbing on your book is, in fact, the Dalai Lama.
Yeah.
And therein lies the difference. How the heck did you get him to blurb your book?
Yeah, for the last 10 years, I have a very close and loving relationship with His Holiness, the Dalai Lama. He's been my teacher and mentor and friend. We've written together many times, and we've done a lot of public events together. When I talked to him about this particular book, he was happy. Now, it is the calmest blurb ever, by the way. The Dalai Lama doesn't say, "This book changed my life." How could it? He says, Arthur Brooks has written a book about how we grow and change, which is pretty descriptive and calm, but he's the Dalai Lama.
He is the Dalai Lama. How did you forge that relationship with him?
Well, I was thinking some years ago about the people that I wanted to know to really project myself into the future and to be able to. I'm a happiness guy. I want to get a bigger audience. I want to start a movement of people around the world who are obsessed with happiness for themselves and for other people. Who do I need to know? And so I wrote to His Holiness the Dalai Lama, to his team, and said, "If I come to Dharamsala in the Himalayan foothills to your monastery, will you see me?" And he said, "Yes." And so I actually went there, went to, you know, Delhi and then Amritsar, and then drove up 6 hours. I almost hit a goat. And when I finally got to Dharamsala and he saw me for an hour, we had this beautiful meeting of the minds, and we've been friends ever since.
You have a real stillness about you, and you also have a real lightness of touch, you know, and that's really important when getting any kind of message across, especially the message of happiness. If people come and see you at Harvard, can they spend like 3 years on a happiness degree? How does it work there?
Well, I teach happiness at the Harvard Business School, right, which is really the craziest thing. You'd think that I was teaching supply chain management or something incredibly practical like that, but I get the students in their last semester before they graduate and go work, become titans of private equity and hedge funds and all that important stuff. And they're realizing that they're actually not on a trajectory to be happy. They're on a trajectory to be rich and powerful and perhaps famous, but not necessarily happy. And that is a big skill that's lacking. And so I put in their toolkit this happiness plan so that each decade of their life they have a fighting chance of actually becoming happier people, not just richer and more powerful people. And it's one of the most popular classes at Harvard at this point, because people are recognizing how important that is for their lives.
I mean, that is fantastic, isn't it? Because when you're that young, you feel like you can conquer the world anyway, yeah, hopefully at least. And you'd think that your class would be swimming against the tide. So in many ways, they are showing sort of wisdom ahead of their own curve, aren't they?
Yeah.
To be willing to listen to that kind of stuff.
Yeah, well, they're actually showing fear is what motivates a lot of people. What they're finding is that they're getting their dreams are starting to come true. I mean, a lot of these people are these big strivers as kids. You know, they're sort of objectified by their parents as the special one, perfect marks in these private schools, and then they go on to the best university in the United States, perhaps in the world, and then the best business school, and they recognize they're actually not getting happier. And they recognize that what they're doing probably won't bring them the satisfaction. It's putting them on this treadmill of more, 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 more. And so I have to explain certain ideas like your satisfaction doesn't come from what you have. It's what you have divided by what you want. You don't need, as you get older, to have more. You need to want less. Now, that's a hard pill to swallow when you're going to business school. But once they absorb that, it can be really life-changing.
I mean, you say the Rolling Stones were sort of ahead of the game. They almost got it right, but they got a little bit wrong,
yeah,
didn't they? So what was the nuance there?
Who got a little bit wrong?
I can't get no satisfaction.
Yeah,
I can't keep my satisfaction.
Yeah, that's exactly right. So Mick Jagger, it's an interesting thing. During the coronavirus epidemic, when I was locked down in my house in suburban Boston, and my little girl, who was a senior in high school, she was 18 at the time, I find her not in Zoom school, you know, the sorry excuse for school that we... She was actually laughing uproariously at the kitchen table, looking looking at a YouTube video. I said, honey, what are you looking at? And she said, I'm watching a video of an old man dancing like a chicken and trying to sing. And I thought, well, I'm not above looking at somebody making an idiot of himself on the internet because I'm a shallow person. So I come in to look at the video. It's Mick Jagger, friends. Mick Jagger, who is in a 2017 performance of I Can't Get No Satisfaction. He's like 100 at this point, right? And she didn't know who he was. And she said, do you people like this? By which she meant old people.
Older people.
And I took great umbrage at that. But then she said, why is it popular? And I said, it's the message. Now, it's not quite right. It's not true that you can't get no satisfaction, if only, because then you wouldn't keep searching for it and wasting your life. The problem is you can't keep no satisfaction. You can get it, but it's evanescent. It's elusive. It you know, we all know that new car smell, it goes away. You move to California for the weather and 6 months later, you're just as depressed, but the taxes are forever.
Yeah.
I mean, life is tricky that way. And so we're looking for these goals, but we can't keep that satisfaction. The way to deal with that is not a have more strategy, it's to want less.
Yeah, so satisfaction is fueled by the fundamentals of dopamine. Dopamine is the molecule of more, and good luck with that.
Exactly right. It's the molecule of anticipation of more. It doesn't even give you a payoff.
Yeah.
It just makes you run on the treadmill.
So I'm with you. So I want to want less.
Yeah.
I want to want not much at all. But I've now fallen into the trap, and you know about this, of having to manage my lessness.
Yeah.
Which again is a desire.
Oh, for sure.
Isn't it?
No, absolutely.
So desiring less is still a desire.
It's still an attachment.
And
so,
the attachment.
So the key is non-attachment. And there's all kinds of ways to do this. By the way, the idea of attachments only to physical things is a big mistake. You know, I have an exercise as a happiness specialist. I have an exercise on my birthday. My birthday was 3 days ago, by the way.
Happy birthday.
Thank you very much. I turned 58 years old, and I feel great, I have to say, but I look in the mirror and I realize that the years are passing. And on my birthday, I used to have a bucket list. For your listeners who don't know, it's a very American concept. You look at all your cravings and all of your goals and attachments to fire up your ambition. Basically, it just makes you feel like a loser for all the things you haven't done. Now I have a reverse bucket list, where I make a list of all of the things to which I'm attached and make a strategic plan for detaching myself from them. So a few years ago, for example, on my birthday, I gave away 3/4 of my clothes. But that wasn't hard enough. So last year, I gave away half of my political opinions. Now, that's a kind of a non-attachment. And think about this. It's basically to say, I made a list of all the things I really, really cared about politically. I said, I don't care about that anymore. I'm going to listen to people who disagree with me more. I'm telling you, Chris, I'm free. It's like it's taking an anvil off my shoulders.
I know. Reserve the right to have no opinion.
Oh, it's just unbelievable.
You don't need to have an opinion.
You don't. You don't have to be freaked out and fired up about absolutely everything. It's the great thing about being here in the UK is I hear people that, families breaking apart about Brexit. And I can say, oh, interesting arguments on both sides.
Yeah, exactly. Because so, it's not happening to you. It's so easy, much more easy to sort of spectate and almost enjoy.
Yeah, and now I can do that in the States because I gave away half of my political opinions.
I love that. So there's the bucket list, there's the effort list, and then there's the chuck it list. So you're chucking it out.
Yeah, that's the reverse bucket list. Exactly right.
Oh, I love it. Can you speak to my favorite social experiment of all time? Do you remember the one where they studied the men of all different demographics over decades and decades and decades, and the conclusions from that, and the TED talk from that?
This is a study from it's called the Harvard Study of Adult Development.
It's amazing.
This is an 84-year longitudinal study starting in the late 1930s of men who were graduating from Harvard University. They blended it with a sample of people who didn't go to college, and then it became more demographically representative. So it wasn't just white men, it was men and women and people of all different races. And they tracked them all the way until they died. 17 members of the study are actually still alive, of the hundreds and hundreds they started with. But then their kids and grandkids, and it's unbelievable how much data they have. And they have a list of the things of the people who wound up healthy and happy. This is what we want. That quadrant of both healthy and happy. What did they all do? And some of it was obvious. I mean, don't smoke cigarettes. I mean, who doesn't know that at this point? Don't drink to excess. And if you're worried about it, don't drink at all. Make sure that you're getting plenty of exercise. And the way to do this is walk an hour a day. But look, your grandmother could have told you that. But the really interesting things come in. You should read for an hour a day. You should find a way to deal with your problems so you're not ruminating on them. If you need help, go see a therapist, whatever that happens. But the number one thing on a walk is love. Happiness is love, full stop. And that means all kinds of love. Love for the divine, if you're a religious person. Certainly love for your family. because of Brexit, don't break down with your family. That is insanity. That is stepping over $100 bills to get to nickels. It is the dumbest thing that you can possibly do, is to have family breakdown over politics. It's idiotic. The third thing is real friendship. We all know the difference between real friends and deal friends. And as real strivers, you know, people are listening to us that are, you know, busting their picks 16 hours a day, tons of deal friends. Do you have real friends? You know the difference. And finally, making sure that your work serves your fellow humans. Love for the divine, love for your family, love for your friends, love through people through work. That's the secret of happiness.
It's all in the book. So there's falling in love, but as you get into your second curve, real joy is staying in love.
Yeah, it certainly is. And especially in, when I talk about romance, one of the, there are two things that my students always come to talk to me about in office hours. You know, they come to say, Professor Brooks, you know, I'm reading all these neuroscience papers and that's really, really great and all that, but tell me how to fall in love and stay in love. And the second is actually, what should I do about my religious life? Because they're all kind of on this spiritual journey, which is actually really important, of course. On the on the falling in love part, it's interesting. I do a lot of research on internet dating and about these patterns from millennials. And the fact is, millennials in the States, but also here in the UK, are 30 percentage points less likely to say that they are in love than people were in their 20s when you and I were in our 20s. Now, Chris, that's catastrophic. You know, what's the point
for,
of being...
For who? For them or for us?
It's for the civilization. I mean, it's like, the point of being in your 20s is falling in love. What else is there in your 20s? Everything else is a pretext to, you know, give you the time and means to fall in love. And when there's less marriage, there's less cohabitation, there's less love, there's less romantic love, you got big problems. And so I talk to them about all the things that are going wrong. Internet dating is catastrophic. It's matching people with too much political compatibility. It's got no complementarity between people. Nobody's is talking about what the real secret to love is. Not just passion. It's admiration. It's respect. It's friendship is really what comes down to it. And a lot of young people today, they don't actually know how to make friends. So how are they actually going to fall in love? I mean, my best friend, it's my wife, Esther. I mean, she actually understands me. She loves me despite me.
She cherishes and tolerates you.
It's the craziest thing ever. I have no idea how she accomplishes that, but just because we're best friends, actually.
It. We're racing through the book, but we have to. This book is amazing. From Strength to Strength, Arthur C. Brooks, New York Times bestselling author. We've all read this book cover to cover. We couldn't put it down. We've all made notes. Here comes the next one. Tell us about play dates for the OGs.
Yeah, yeah. So the old timers, one of the biggest problems that you have, if you're an aging striver and you have lots and lots of deal friends, you may not have the real friend chops anymore. And so I meet a lot of guys in the United States, the loneliest people are 60-year-old men. I mean, you'd think that as a 60-year-old man, you'd have some skills when it comes to friends. Not so much. I mean, I meet people, especially those who work really hard, that don't have any real friendships. And so you find that they retire and they're desperately lonely. So what happens is that there's this movement, actually started here in the UK, also in Australia, but in the United States, sort of the Anglosphere, I guess, called men's sheds. It's actually kind of depressing, but it's a good idea that's behind it, where they have these sheds, these tool sheds or craft sheds in these neighborhoods, and women with their retired husbands will just take them there and leave them there with other guys. Well, they'll build a birdhouse together or something, these guys that they've never met, because what happens? Women bond largely over conversations about their feelings. Men have... To men, the most mysterious thing ever is your feelings. Like, Chris, how are you feeling? It's like, what? I don't know. You know, I have.
What do you mean?
I have sons. You know, it's my middle son. He's a Marine Special Forces. This guy's a tough hombre, 6'5", covered in tattoos. He can kill you with his pinky finger, but he cannot tell you how he feels. That's mysterious to him. It's like, you know, one of the mysteries of the universe. So what happens? These guys go through life never being able to figure this out. So, but they need friendship, because we all need this kind of platonic love. So what do? You have to have shared activities. And if you've never done that before, these sheds, your wife takes you there and you say, you can't come out till you've built a birdhouse with your friend Bill.
Yeah.
And it turns out to be the salve on the soul for these guys. They start becoming happier. Strange.
Yeah, as long as it works, it doesn't matter how it works, I don't think. So let's slip and slide towards the spiritual via intrinsic versus extrinsic goals.
There's a lot of research that shows that we have a tendency to think. And on the first day of class, at my MBA students, 27 years old, Harvard University, I say, what would make you remarkably happier as a person? And they talk about things happening. happening to them. They talk about, the woman I'm in love with agrees to marry me if they have that relationship. They talk about if I get that job that pays really well, if I finish my degree with honors, whatever it happens to be. And I say, wrong. Why? Because circumstances don't last for your happiness. Again, you can't keep no satisfaction. That's the nature of the brain. It's a phenomenon called homeostasis. There's an actual neuroscientific reason for that that goes back to the Pleistocene, why you can't keep no satisfaction. So what do you need to do? You need to look inward for your satisfaction, not externally. Extrinsic rewards are looking to the outside world to bring you happiness. Intrinsic rewards are all about love. They're all about relationships. They're all about the satisfactions that come that you manufacture inside your own heart and inside your own soul. And you find that people who say that my ambitions are about having better relationships with my kids, with my parents, with my friends, with the people that I love romantically, they're the ones 10 years later who have fewer physical maladies, they have less depression, they have less anxiety. But the ones who say, I'll be happy if I'm the CEO, woe be unto them.
So if you tap your own well of love and care and gratitude, that then forever flows, doesn't
Absolutely.
It?
Absolutely. Chris, you've got it. You nailed it. And the question is, can people do that before they're our age? it's a
Maybe
tricky thing.
Maybe you're not allowed. It's like the rite of passage of you know, the younger generations. You know, like the Beatles couldn't help themselves. They wrote like 3 or 4 hits every week. And then as certain artists get older, they can't get arrested in the charts. It's just what you're allowed to do. It's recognizing what nature wants to give you at particular times, not getting caught on one particular perch and being happy to flow down the river, but you still have your own paddle, if you like.
Exactly right. And this is the nature of what we started talking about earlier. Look, you've got your fluid intelligence that makes you a big star, a striver that can achieve innovation, creativity, focus. But later in life, it really is all about the relationships, the wisdom, the teaching, the way that you can work with other people. And when you cultivate that, if you can go from Mark Zuckerberg to the Dalai Lama, boy, that's the trick. If you can walk from one curve to the next. But every single person listening to us, when they get into their 40s, they're going to notice that what used to be easy gets harder. And things that are relational, they're instructional, the things that you can share your wisdom, those things weirdly start getting easier. Start moving your career, start moving your life to those skills, and you will get happier.
Yeah, and I think the discomfort is more palpable as you get older, because you know thyself, your true nature, you know, comes shining through, and you're thinking, you know, I'm getting this wrong, but it's because you're feeling more right.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And a lot of people, they regret the fact that things have gotten harder. They feel ashamed of the fact that some of these skills tend to be waning, and they shouldn't be doing that. They should be celebrating the fact that their life is changing. They're getting the consolations of age. You know, left to our devices, if we actually live on this second curve, we will get happier. Look, everybody listening to us, here's my guarantee. Don't leave it up to chance. If you use the skills correctly, you can be happier at 75 than you were at 25. You actually can do that, but you must cultivate the skills that actually come with age.
Yeah, and you're not selling snake oil here, because you know you have a dog in the race. You have some skin in the game with your book, but this is, you're not trying to get a sign up for some lucrative online course. You're just saying it's there, take it.
Yeah, absolutely. No, this is free for all. God gave it to
Love it.
It's just the most beautiful thing, I have to say. And I'm 58, and I'm actually looking forward to 78 because I did the research. I ate my own cooking. I did this for three. I actually started working on this project for 3 years.
Recipes.
I actually did, and I didn't. I wasn't even going to publish this as a book, but my wife found my notes. I was doing this research on myself to see if I could get happier, and she found the notes. Said you should send this to your agent.
Yep.
I said I don't know. It turns out there are a lot of people who want to be happier. Weird, right?
Yeah, the best research is me search, which ends up, thank you to people like yourself, as we search. So we're going to take all that. We get to Buddhism. Of course we get to Buddhism.
Yeah.
And we get, my favorite chapter is the chapter about India and the 4 different seasons. We've got 2 minutes left. Do what you want with those.
Yeah, well, one of the things that you find in the great Indian gurus, they say that life is in 4 quarters. The student phase early on called Brahmacharya, the householder phase where you're building your career called Grihastha and your family. But the 3rd and 4th phases are the magic phases of life, starting sometime in 45 or 50, Vanaprastha, which means retiring into the forest, from 2 words in Sanskrit. And you don't have to literally retire into the forest, but you need to back away from your worldly ambitions and start to think about the sources of your true joy, such that you can get to that 4th quarter, which is sannyasa, enlightenment, one in being with Brahman, the creator. And you figure out what that means for you. But the bottom line is you got to do the work. And the work is intensely about you, about becoming non-attached, about wanting less, about loving more. If you want less stuff, if you want and you pursue more love, Vanaprastha will be yours and sannyasa is your future.
Yeah, and the whole thing is, you know, if you want less, it means you have some stuff. And yeah. So if you want less, all you have to do is discard it. And there's that whole thing about being tethered in a hot air balloon.
Yeah.
You know, for that balloon to rise, you don't have to expend more hot air. You just got to cut those lines.
Exactly right. And again, there's nothing wrong with stuff. The problem is basically loving stuff.
Yep.
There's nothing wrong with having a relationship with people that's in terms of business, but don't use people. Here's how I end the book. The world tells you to use people, love things, and worship yourself, and it's all wrong. You need to take the verbs and nouns and mix them up. You should use things, that's fine, love people only, and worship the divine, and the future is yours.
Wow. Congratulations. Thank goodness your wife found your notes.
Yeah. I know. Who knows what else she's found, but I'm
what was
a lucky
she looking
man.
For? That's the question. Why was she rooting around there in the first place? That's what I want to know. You're on with our pal Rich Roll in a couple of weeks. Have you recorded that podcast?
Yeah, I've recorded that podcast already. Rich Roll's phenomenal because he's somebody who's truly on his second curve. And yeah. He's an example to all of us. I've been a longtime fan of Rich's and now a friend.
You know, and the second curve is all, it's a metaphor. It's a reflection of the resurrection, isn't it? That's,
yeah.
That's the thing there, isn't it?
Sure is. You sure are doing a lot right, Chris. Are you happier and happier as the years go by?
Happier as the seconds go by.
It's crazy, isn't it?
Yeah, and that whole thing about Michael A. Singer, you know, keep the heart open. Because, you know, if the door's closed, nothing can get through. And if the door's... Just keep them. Release, relax. Relax and release.
How many decades have you been in the business?
This business?
Yeah.
It's coming up for 4.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah. I mean, we know you across the pond.
Okay. Well, let's have that discussion off the air, purely because we're running out of time, because my favorite subject is me. Unless it's you, of course.
Thank you. And now it's we.
Yeah, it is. Arthur Seabrooks, New York Times bestselling author. Got to get this book from strength to strength. Thank you so much, Arthur.
Thank you, Chris. Great being with you.
Thank you, Vassos. Thank you, Rachel. Thank you, team. And we'll see you all on Wednesday. Goodbye.
The best of the Chris Evans Breakfast Show with Sky.
Virgin Radio.
Thank you so much for listening. And if you do like what you're hearing, please remember to rate this episode and review it. And also, why not listen back to some of our other podcasts from Dawn French and even Matthew McConaughey. All right. Adios. Bye-bye.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more, with Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to Quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.